Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this November the 26th on the West Coast, now November the 27th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome all of you who are listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world, and I want to especially give a tribute to those who have joined us in Central and South America, as well as the Spanish-speaking peoples of Europe, especially Spain. And since this is on the heels of a holiday celebration, I'm going to play a little music for you folks, just to show you that on Evident Footprints, we cover the whole gamut. And I'm going to feature something from Jam Miami. This was the Miami All-Star Jazz Band, which featured many well-known Latin musicians, Arturo Sandoval, Chick Corea, who's known in jazz circles in America. He's known for his classical technique and his great improvisational skills, his own bands, many of them, over the years, and a few musicians who worked with Carlos Santana and some of the big band players. Really good horn section. This was a concert piece from the year 2000, September 26th, I think, 2000. This was recorded. It's called Wahi Waro, or Soul Sauce. This is for my Latin listeners. Wahi Waro. Wahi Waro. Thank you.
Fujiwara. Fujiwara.
That's the Miami Latin All-Stars and Wachiwara, and that's for our Latin listeners out there around the world. Welcome to Evident Footprints. This is my third year anniversary. This is the first show of the next year at BBS Radio, so we're having a little bit of a party. I hope some of you danced out there. with that, I'm going to invite along... as my co-host tonight, my regular Friday night guest. He has been with me since the beginning. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, and my co-host every Friday night on Evident Footprints, and our resident science advisor, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Don. That was an interesting piece you played. I remember that from somewhere. I've definitely heard it before. It's a good one.
You probably danced to it.
No, not necessarily, but I definitely remember it.
Well, I've been playing music over the past few weeks, sort of as a crutch to get us outside of the box, or maybe an incentive or a motive for getting outside of the box, tuning into different frequencies, especially. Those frequencies that liberate the soul and open up the heart center. And you and I have been doing a number of shows on consciousness, on power production, the hidden and suppressed technologies that are available to us. And over the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about your work. And last week, we talked about the Tesla wave. And I know that we could say a lot more about that, and let's continue our discussion, if you will, along the lines of what we talked about. I'm sure you had some time this week to think about what we said, and we got a lot of really interesting comments from listeners who said that there was a lot of truth coming out and a lot of new information they hadn't heard before. So hopefully, we'll have a show like that tonight.
Well, I'm glad that that's the case. I always try to introduce information that's of interest. And, you know, I really do it for a number of reasons. Well, first of all, as you know, it's my passion to delve into these things. But more than that, it's also, it's kind of like a little bit of a return, you might say, to the good fortunes that I've had over the years. Different people that have taught me stuff and opened my eyes to different things, which allow me to be what I am now. And so, in a similar vein, I like to give out as much information as I can for other people to contemplate and maybe pursue. I can't divulge everything directly for a number of reasons, but primarily because it would impact my own work in a negative way, which I don't want to do right now. But I thought that it would be an interesting thing to backtrack just a little bit with the Tesla information, and recount this very interesting anecdote about Tesla's work in downtown New York City. And as you probably know, and I know we've talked about this before on earlier shows, Tesla was a master of the entire concept of vibration. He used it mostly in his electrical and radio work. But as we all know, it doesn't matter what you're vibrating, whether it's the ether or the air or, you know, some light source somewhere. once the information is encoded, you wind up with a wave that takes on the impressed characteristics and operates in accordance with the laws particular to that realm. So it was not that difficult for him to jump from one species of science to another in order to try his concepts across the board. And what I'm leading up to, of course, is Tesla's experiments with his mechanical oscillator. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was a small air-powered device about the size of a can of beans. You know, it wasn't that big. He could fit it under a derby hat, and he bragged about that quite a bit. And he had it secured to one of the main support pillars in his laboratory, which ran down from the upper loft through the office sections and right down into the foundations of the building, which were apparently resting on bedrock. And as a result of that, when he started this device up, which was air-powered, the result after a few minutes was that he created an earthquake in downtown Manhattan. And that's actually on the records. I mean, people, you can go and look that up. If there really was an earthquake. And the interesting thing was it didn't affect the epicenter quite so much as it did the surrounding area. And by the time Tesla realized how bad it really was, the only way he could stop it fast enough was to wallop his device with a sledgehammer. But the interesting thing was that in the surrounding blocks, apparently it was pretty intense. I mean, it broke windows and it moved big pieces of furniture around and had people terrified running out into the streets, and loose masonry was coming down. And the reason that I chose to open with this little story is because the general notion in today's scientific community regarding Tesla's work in that area seems to be that it's a myth. As a matter of fact, there was a show not too long ago on Mythbusters where they attempted to use what they thought was a Tesla oscillator to bring down this steel truss bridge, which was slated for demolition. And it barely even vibrated. And so as a result of that, they came to the conclusion, the Mythbusters themselves, that it had to be a myth because they couldn't do it. And I really laughed my way through that whole show because the interesting thing is that what allows this type of phenomenon to manifest is the utilization of this Tesla wave that we had been talking about. And the reason it works is really quite interesting. It's because the wave has the incredible ability to prepay the deficit, if you will, on the anticipated dissipation of energy in the system. And as a result of that, it has a very similar effect in mechanics, as, you would find, for instance, in, what do they call that? Resistance-less electrical transmission or superconductivity. It has a very same effect as that. And as a result of that, amplitudes build so rapidly and to such an enormous extent that they are capable of creating damage. And so the mere outcome of the Mythbusters experiment, it didn't debug Tesla at all. What it really did was it debugged the Mythbusters because it became very evident that they didn't have a clue as to how to achieve the proper waveform to demolish this bridge.
Yeah, sometimes, Jim, I think those shows are produced with a predetermined outcome in mind for the purpose of obfuscating the truth. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, it could very well be the case. I mean, let's face it, Hollywood is controlled by, and so is most of the television industry, you know, by the very forces that want things left the way they are. So there's no reason why that couldn't be true.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole purpose of mentioning it is to bring to light the fact that it's really a very basic and fundamental thing that we're talking about here, and it actually can be done. And I did it myself, not with mechanical vibrations, although I have built a couple of mechanical oscillators, but I've managed to secure the effect electrically, and it's pretty awesome. It really is. And you can do so many unusual things with it once you get handy with it. I just wish that I was 50 years younger and a few million dollars in the bank, and I would do nothing but play with this stuff, because I think that in his lifetime, Tesla definitely pointed the way to some extraordinary technological avenues, and they should be pursued. They should definitely be explored. Only God knows what they lead to. But
yes.
Everything, as you know, is a universe unto itself, and so it's ridiculous to assume that you know, something as obscure as the Tesla wave is just going to be an isolated curiosity unto itself. It's definitely more than that. I mean, Tesla used this feature of his version of electrical physics, let's call it that, to do some totally amazing things. Now, one of the coolest things that I've ever seen, and I wish I had duplicated it, but frankly I haven't, he had a machined block of copper. This was just absolutely a solid rectangular block, probably about a foot long, and let's say, I'm guessing at the dimensions, but let's say 3 inches square on the end. And down the middle of this, across the top surface, he had a series of holes drilled that were obviously not linearly spaced. They were spaced almost like musical notes or some kind of octaves, because the increments between them was totally different down the whole length of this thing. And he had terminals screwed into these holes that had wires coming off of them, and each one of them went to a light fixture. And then on the two far ends of this block, he had a larger set of terminals that went to one of his special oscillators. And the coolest thing was, now this is, I want to remind you, it's a solid block of copper. And yet, his understanding of fundamental wave phenomenon was so incredible that by tuning this oscillator, he could literally light any one of those lamps attached to a solid block without lighting the other ones. And I understand what he was doing. I just don't know how he was doing it. But the interesting thing is, you know, this demonstrates, you know, that the waves that he was using and his understanding of, you know, wavelengths and areas of compression and decompression throughout the structure and the way the electron currents carry actually allowed him to do, you might call it, true solid-state switching within a solid block of copper. I mean, these are pretty amazing things, and it goes to demonstrate his amazing prowess, you know, with waves and electrical theory. And there's I know there's a certain school of thought that thinks that Tesla was a tinkerer and that he didn't really have a solid basis in mathematics. And I'm here to tell you that that's total rubbish. The math that governs these waveforms is so off the wall that even today with computer power, it's still an enormously complicated undertaking to solve the differential equations associated with it.
Quick question, Jim. In terms of these copper blocks that he used, was he tuning them, or was he just able to transmute the information according to what device was actually broadcasting this frequency?
No, the blocks just remained fixed, you might say. I mean, nothing happened with them except their dimensions were very critical. Mm-hmm. But what he was doing was introducing waves into these blocks that literally set up, you might say, like a standing wave inside the length of the block. And because he had these terminals organized in a nonlinear fashion, hot spots of voltage would actually appear in a pre-designated area that had such great potential with respect to the rest of the block that it was capable of lighting a light with respect to, you know, has chosen ground plane. And so just by changing the frequency, he's essentially fitting different size waves in there and moving this hot spot around so that he could literally select which of the several lamps he chose to turn on and off.
Mm-hmm.
Which was pretty cool.
Yeah, was that a directional phenomenon, or was that because the various lights were tuned to specific frequencies?
Well, it's a what do you mean by a directional phenomenon? What is that you're trying to say?
Well, in other words, aiming a beam or aiming the wave at that particular light, as opposed to just having all the different frequencies emanating from the block, and he could selectively turn the frequencies on and on or off, affecting the different.
No,
light.
It was more akin to the second situation.
Okay.
There was nothing aimed at the block. It was actually part of an external circuit. It's just that.
No, I don't mean aimed at the block. I'm saying aimed at the lights themselves.
No, there was nothing aimed at the lights. It was done strictly by fitting different wave shapes into this predetermined volume of space that was represented by the this critically machined copper block.
Okay. Did he come upon, let's say, a frequency that he would say would be the best frequency for operating light bulbs, per se, or other types of devices? Was he interested in that?
Oh, heavens. He had so many patents on different types of lamps that it's really unbelievable. The one that I think was the coolest was the one that he called his carbon button lamp. And it actually led to the discovery of two really important things, one of which was a new type of microscope that allowed him to actually view the disintegration of sample particles placed in this tube. And the second thing, which is even more incredible, was a device which allowed for the production of a high vacuum within a particular enclosure, and then actually have that tube open in such a way that the electrical discharges could literally leave the enclosure without losing the vacuum. And he talks about that quite a few times in some of his lectures. It was one of the primary ingredients in his death ray device. But the carbon button lamp is a really interesting thing because it is, first of all, a very high voltage device, and it's part of a single circuit or a true one wire circuit. It doesn't have a return path, and the electrode that contains the carbon button is basically a hemisphere, and it's got a little pocket in it where he puts these samples. And what he discovered was that when you reach a certain potential, the evacuated bulb, which was quite large, apparently it must have been somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 or 10 inches in diameter, and I guess it must have been coated with something on the inside. But anyway, this carbon button was situated at the geometric center of the evacuated bulb, so that once this voltage was high enough and the discharge began to take place, the field that was created was apparently a convergent field, hemispherically shaped and impinging upon this little target pocket where he put these various samples. And the glass that supported the vacuum was coated with like a phosphorescent material. And the net result was that there was an amplification of many thousands and thousands of multiples of power, which actually allowed the image of the disintegrating particles to appear on the inner surface of the glass. And he used to actually adjust the current and the frequency and the potential and whatnot and watch the effects that it had on these tiny little particles. And according to him, it was very similar to an electron microscope of today.
That's very interesting. Now, was he pursuing, let's say, a more, I don't know if cost-efficient is the word, but for sake of argument, a more cost-efficient type of lighting system?
For sure. Uh-huh. And not only more efficient from the standpoint of, you know, expense of operation, but also having a greater effect on lighting a given area. One of his coolest things, I always thought, was the rediscovery of daylight, and he talks about that. Now, the interesting thing is, this is something which has really interested me for many years, and I've tried, like the Dickens, to find more information on it. I have not been successful. But the very ancient civilizations seem to have had a knowledge of what daylight is. Now, you know, we run to the conclusion that when the sun comes up, it's the light of the sun directly that illuminates everything. But that's incorrect, because when you go out into space, everything is pitch dark, and you can see some sort of a hazy glow off in the direction of the sun, but it certainly isn't a bright luminescent spot that you can't look at. And astronauts have written about that. So the effect of daylight actually occurs in the atmosphere. And it either has something to do with the orgone in the atmosphere or with the oxygen in the atmosphere, or, you know, something specific that takes a radiation, or perhaps it's a high voltage potential, as Tesla suggested, and allows it to interact with something in the atmosphere, and the net result is light. And the reason I mentioned the ancient technologies was because these tombs in the Valley of the Kings and in other places that are so far underground, the most interesting one would be the recent discovery we talked about not too long ago about the tomb of Osiris underneath the Sphinx. These these are in areas that are so inaccessible that it's unbelievable. And the ceilings are all decorated in a lot of these tombs. And if the belief that they used oil lamps to illuminate these areas while they decorated them, if that was true, there would be oil smudges all over the place or soot. And there isn't even a hint of that. Then the other great idea that archaeologists had was that they used huge mirrors and reflected sunlight down these galleries, and directed the sun into various rooms that they were working on. But that wouldn't give them the same effect, even if they achieved it, that you would have if the room was really clearly lit. And their selection of colors and the beautiful organization of their paintings in these tombs suggests that they had to be able to see exactly what they were doing. And so some of these earlier writings hint at the fact that they too understood the production of daylight, and that they could produce daylight in any given room with some very ancient technology that we don't know anything about. And Tesla was very, very much interested in stuff like this. And, he read a lot of material from India and the Far East, and he was fluent in many languages. So he had the availability of scouring libraries and articles that most people would never even dream of, never mind have the wherewithal to read. And he claims that he eventually rediscovered the secret of it, and it is a very high-frequency form of electrostatic field that causes this effect. And his ultimate goal was just to produce light in a room with no fixture. In other words, you wouldn't have a specific light bulb or fluorescent tube or anything of the sort. The room would just be lit, and it wouldn't be lit from a given source. It would just be daylight in the room. And I don't know how far he got with that, but that was his ultimate goal. And in the meantime, he did have somewhat lesser successes along those lines, where he used a large coil above the ceiling of the room, oscillating at a very high frequency, and had various types of discharge tubes situated in the room, and they were giving off very high intensity light with no wires connected whatsoever. So he was really into that kind of stuff, and I'm telling you, he was far more prolific in his investigations than most people realize.
Mm-hmm. In my own research in acoustics, especially, looking at the issue of where, let's say, a speaker will function without experiencing resistance, either because of a circuit or because of something that's absorbing energy, let's say a coil absorbing, the voice coil of the speaker absorbing energy and giving off heat. Not to the level where it would burn out, but it's a natural phenomenon that occurs in acoustics, and it also occurs in electricity, in that you could control an oscillatory peak so that a device is actually not putting out as much electric current or as much voltage, let's say. Now, that's desirable where you have certain types of parts, but I get the impression that Tesla had an understanding of both in terms of his earthquake machine. Maybe it was a device that didn't really exhibit the characteristics of damping occurring. In other words, he was able to get a wave to move through the device or from the device that that didn't degrade. In other words, it didn't have a damping factor.
Yeah, and that's exactly right.
Is it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the whole point. Yeah, I mean, that's the reason why it could do what it did.
Mm-hmm.
Was because the amount of energy that would normally be lost in whatever the damping effect was literally prepaid by the wave. So in other words, it was designed, you might say it was custom built to have a particular effect and supply a particular amplitude. And in doing so, it literally was imbued with the necessary characteristics to prepay the loss factor mm-hmm. in a given environment. And as a result of that, it operated as if there was no loss.
Yes. You see, the average consumer device that we buy, whether it's a little portable stereo system or a radio or a cell phone or a computer, any of these devices that operate on frequency and various frequencies operating pretty much all the time or periodically according to how you're using the device, seems to me that they could incorporate this technology into things and it wouldn't wear out. Imagine if they did that to a car, for example, or a motorcycle or an airplane. You know, commercial airliner. And I think using all the different modalities and even adapting that to other modalities, let's say more of a mechanical nature. Transportation.
Well, my feeling on what you just said is that if that was extrapolated to the nth degree, with understanding, of course, you would probably wind up with some form of spaceship. Because Tesla himself came to that conclusion. I mean, if you read some of the things that he wrote, and I don't have them with me tonight, or I would definitely reread them on the air, but he described a vehicle that he was interested in building. And he had experimented with whatever the power source was, and it was certainly not an airplane. It had no wings. It had no external props or propellers or, you know, anything that you could visually point at that would give a hint of an aerodynamic device. And yet he talked about this thing moving at unbelievable velocities, levitating, standing still, in a geocentric orbit. And I mean, he described everything about it that you often hear in association with the subject of UFOs. And so I can't prove it, but one of the things I've always wondered was if his research finally led him to such an understanding of things that that's where he wound up. And it could be, because there have been many, many suggestions over the years that inertia is actually an electrical phenomenon, or to put it another way, it's a reaction that occurs between the charge on a given object and the effect that charge has on the ether when a body is moved. Mm-hmm. And so if that's true, you know what we're talking about? We're talking about a higher octave of the lens force. You know, it's just another way of looking at a natural phenomenon that causes a resistance to motion. I mean, the same thing happens in electrical generating devices that we use today.
If I were to extrapolate a bit further on that, then wouldn't symbiosis, in other words, a symbiotic craft that could sense the thoughts of an individual and operate by thought, then would may possibly just be a harmonic of this wave?
Well, now you're into something that I know absolutely nothing about, but I would say
I'm just thinking outside the box, that's all. Go ahead.
No, I would say that once you have come up with a method of actually securing such a result, I don't see any problem whatsoever with integrating it into some type of a control system that could influence its operation by thought alone. I mean, they're doing that now with the weapon systems in some of these jet planes and in some of the other so-called highly secretive devices that they've been playing around with all these, what do they call them, black funding operations and what have you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just a normal extension of that philosophy, then, that if you discover something new in way of motive force, if it turns out that it gets to be so fast that the human responses are not fast enough, then obviously you'd control it by computer, and you wouldn't want a mechanical input to the computer under those conditions. So you would simply send instructions to the computer, you know, directly from the electromagnetic output of the brain. I think that's all very conceivable.
Now, Jim, the process of flight and movement through space at extremely rapid speeds occurs, let's say, with the United Galactic Federation ships. They tune into frequencies that they have mapped throughout space. And these frequencies are identifiable over and over again because they exist at a frequency, and they represent a dimensional portal. So they're able to travel through these portals. In other words, now, if there is a frequency, they're able to tune in and map and computerize so that they can pull it out whenever they need to off of, let's say, their hard drive or whatever system they use to store data. Could be a crystal. I think we have the recognition that there is a frequency being emanated from somewhere else. Now, the big question would be, where is that frequency coming from? What's causing that frequency to be able to be detected and then utilized? Have you given anything like that thought in your work?
Sure. As a matter of fact, this takes us right back to the whole Goetz situation, where he used to talk about these so-called lines of force that actually represent what he called the breath of the universe. And essentially, he looked upon these lines as almost a grid in space, that if you mapped it, it would look like kind of like the artificial lines of latitude and longitude that are painted on a terrestrial globe. Mm-hmm. Except they wouldn't be composed of anything solid. They're just composed of lines of stress. And depending on where you are in the universe, they cross each other at different angles. They create shapes which vary from being approximately square to being somewhat triangular. And, they interact with each other, forming these local vortices at different frequencies, again, as a virtue of their size and location. But what's interesting about it is, this is kind of inherent in the message without being explicit, but if you had a situation like that, and if these lines were expanding and contracting under the so-called influence of the breath of the universe, it means that they're stretching and compressing sort of like rubber bands, just like as if you had a globe made out of a balloon, and the lines of latitude and longitude were painted on the balloon, and you had a certain amount of air surging in and out of the balloon at a rhythmic rate, the dimensions of these lines would be changing.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about it is the changes would be longitudinal and not transverse. And so the way I look at it is that these waves or these so-called frequencies are really compressions and rarefactions that occur along these galactic channels or along these spatial grids. And I don't know anything about them personally, but it's not too difficult to hypothesize that if you have a vehicle that's designed to travel on one of these things, it probably not only can move along the line, but it may even take a good deal of its operational power right out of the line that it's moving on once it gets going. And, you know, who knows what the upper end is when it comes to that kind of speed. I definitely do not believe that the speed of light is a limiting factor. I think that's a lot of nonsense. I think that the thing that we call the speed of light is really a polarization effect. It's the timing of the polarization of etheric needles as mm-hmm. they come into alignment and create the phenomenon that we call light. And further, I believe that that this 186,000 miles per second that everybody is measuring is an average value. It's already known that there are things that travel faster than the traditional speed of light. Cherenkov radiation travels faster than that number. Lots of things do. And Tesla talked about the fact that in his wireless transmission station, the initial velocity was actually infinite, and that it slowed down to the speed of light and then went negative, returning to infinity at the other end of the spectrum. Now, I don't know what that means to have infinite speed, but I do understand that, you know, that the wave that he was considering as being responsible for these transmissions was in effect, if you plot it, it was in effect a tangential wave. And of course, a tangent starts at positive infinity, slows down, goes through zero, and then, you know, starts to steeply accelerate the other way and goes to and ends up going to negative infinity. It does that twice in a full cycle. So there's probably all kinds of things that exist which our science refuses to investigate or acknowledge. And a lot of it is simply because they don't like the idea of anything flying in the face of certain established and highly treasured physics, foundational physics, like, for instance, you know, Einsteinian relativity, for instance. I mean, actually, so many holes have been shot in that in the last 30 years that I'm surprised they even still teach it. But there are some diehards which, you know, refuse to believe that there can be anything wrong with it. And yet Tesla himself opposed the theory, you know, back in the 1920s because he said it's impossible for it to be correct. Nobody ever listened to him, but they certainly embraced Einstein's work. And that's got to be the result of political and financial influence, because Tesla was way smarter than people give him credit for.
Well, there's no doubt about that whatsoever. Just on the basis of how many of his inventions were stolen from him, why, if they're not worth anything, why steal them? You know, why steal his notebook?
Or,
you know what I'm saying.
I had a little bit of personal experience with that thing. Yeah, of course. That's the whole point. And, you know, it's interesting we talk about the Blue Notebook because I actually wound up seeing it. And I still believe that it was somehow related to Tesla. And that it probably did convey some interesting information. But if you read, I believe it's John O'Neill's biography of Tesla called The Prodigal Genius. If it isn't in there, it's in some of the other earlier writings concerning Tesla. But there were 13 footlockers containing notes and notebooks and small models of different inventions and whatnot, which had been stored in a loft building in Brooklyn, New York. And I don't know whatever became of all that stuff, but when I was a kid and I heard about that, I went out of my way to try to figure out where those things were. So, you know, there's so much stuff floating around, and somebody knows where it is. Somebody's got it. The other story, which is very interesting, that keeps surfacing, is that Tesla had a secret laboratory that was in a really bizarre place. I can't remember the name of the...
Would it be Washington, D.C.?
I mean, No. It was in New York, but if you've ever seen West Side Highway before they tore it down in Lower Manhattan, it used to have these sections that supported, you know, various spans of the highway, and yet they were all bricked off underneath, and they had windows, and the city used to store equipment in there, like salt trucks for the winter time, and you know, all different things like that. And there were quite a few of these things. They went from almost from the battery all the way up to Henry Hudson, the beginning of the Henry Hudson Bridge. So there was a lot of them. And I can't remember the name of the guy, but there was a doctor, somebody or another, another mysterious individual that seemed to wander in and out of Tesla's life. And together they supposedly secured space in one of those storage facilities and were doing some kind of secretive research there that was separated from as main laboratories, originally on Houston Street, and then later on, 40th and right near Bryant Park, anyway. I forget the street address. So, I mean, there's so much stuff that went on in that man's life that it's really amazing. And I think we wound up with very, very little of what the guy actually had to offer. And yet that small amount changed this planet more so perhaps than anything else has in the last 500 years or so.
Can much of this technology be produced at a fairly reasonable cost, or is it because of the way things are today prohibitive to try to produce some of these devices that you're talking about?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the things that I've built and duplicated of Tesla's work were expensive because I don't have any money. But by normal R&D standards, they're cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it, if you can build a different type of generator or a different type of motor or a different type of transformer, which provides more power or more power per pound or whatever it is you're trying to achieve. And let's say that the first prototypes cost you, I don't know, pick a number, $750,000. That's peanuts. It's a lot of money to people like you and me, but it's peanuts. You turn around then, once you've got the thing operating, and mass produce them, and, you know, you'll end up selling them for somewhere around $300 or $400 a piece, and you make tens of thousands of them. I mean, the amount of money that's associated with something like that is astronomical. This is exactly what they've done with Tesla's three-phase motor. I mean, nowadays they're dirt cheap. They don't even bother to replace them unless they're larger than 7.5 horsepower or so. They just throw them away. And they stamp them out by the hundreds of thousands, and they'll, you know, cost you anywhere from, let's say, $50 or $60 for a small one up to a couple hundred dollars for a fairly large one, and, of course, more for the heavy horsepowers. But they're produced so cheaply that they don't even bother to replace them. And so I think that it's the same old story. It's where you want to put your emphasis and your resources. And then the laws of supply and demand and the incredible advantages of mass production all fall into place, and you'll wind up making enormous amounts of profit. So the real thing is, I mean, you can do that with anything. They do it with cars. They do it with toasters. You know, they do it with electric motors. I'm sure you can do it with almost anything. The real question is, you know, do the powers that be want something on the market or not? If they want it out there, it makes an appearance, I guarantee you. If they don't want it out there, then one of two things happen. Either it never gets produced, or if the inventor is a little bit too frisky and too determined, then he has a heart attack, or a safe falls on his head from 30 floors up, or he gets in a car accident, or, you know, something like that happens.
Or an encounter with the TSA.
What's that?
Or an encounter with the TSA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that'll be the next thing. They'll detain you in one of the viewing things for longer than necessary and roast your gonads while they're examining you.
Well, Jim, we're at the conclusion of tonight's show. Actually, I want to play a song from Lucinda Drayton. This, to me, is the Tesla wave in music before we say goodnight. So if you bear with me for a few minutes here.
Sure, go right ahead.
Jim, I don't know if you agree with me that that's the Tesla wave, but certainly I can interpret it that way. It's really, really soothing music.
Yeah, as I told you earlier tonight, I would really like to find out what that type of a waveform would sound like if we generated it acoustically. I have not yet done that. So maybe we can attempt that together sometime.
Oh, I'd love to do that. Well, Jim, it's been a great show. I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. I know you probably worked through your Thanksgiving.
I took the day off yesterday, but I did work today, though.
Okay. So at least I was right about that. Certainly we can revisit this topic. I think the more we talk about it, the more ideas will flow, and hopefully there are some listeners out there that understand what we're talking about and possibly are working on such devices. Any closing remark you'd like to make?
Well, the only thing I would really like to do is eventually get to the point where I can talk about this stuff openly. I'm looking forward to doing that someday, and I think it'll be very intriguing to see what happens if and when we do reach that plateau of achievement. It will be very enlightening, to say the least.
Well, I agree with you, and I'd be honored if we did that on this show as well. Jim, you have a great weekend. I look forward to seeing you in the month of December. You'll be back next Friday with us. So I wish you the best.
Well, thank you, Don. I look forward to being with you again, as usual, and you have a great week.
All right, you too. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com and tonight's special guest, Jim Murray. I want to thank Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world for broadcasting the show either live or on an archive. Over at bbsradio.com tonight, we have Seth Hendrick on the audio. Donna Doug Newsom, I'd like to thank for making Evident Footprints possible, and this is the start of another year, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun. Most of all, I'd like to thank you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday when my special guest will be Dr. A. Drew Ott. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.